Welcome back to Gamble's Green Room. I'm your host, Mike Gamble, bringing you the people you need to know with the stories you want to hear. Today, I'm joined by a bro of mine. You may have seen him as Victor on the 2000 series Dollhouse with Lyda Dusku. You may have seen him on Existence. You might know him from Agent Carter and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He's also been in a number of other TV shows like Community. He's made a number of appearances in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Just said Agent Carter and Agent S.H.I.E.L.D. And he's actually played a young Robert De Niro in the movie Stone. We'll talk about all that and stuff. Bro, yeah, I remember cuts. You, bro. I know who you are.
deep cuts.
And he's also done some theater as well. I'm talking about the one and only, my bro, Enver Jokai in the house.
Dude, what's up? Thanks for having me, man.
No, thanks for being here. It's taking time out of your professional life to sit here and talk with me as a friend.
I'm totally going to pretend that there's some busy, like, professional schedule that I'm pushing to the side. No, I'm waiting to go to Vancouver next week to start a job. So this is, I told you a little bit off camera, but this is the sweet spot for an actor is when you've booked something, but you're not going to go do it for another week. And there's not really enough time for you to do anything else. So I'm just kind of, this is perfect timing for me.
But okay. So the project that you're leaving for this week is what's going to be like for the next couple months.
It is. This is what I've been doing lately is this show called Invasion for Apple TV, and great show. I get to work with Golshifteh Farhani. She is a phenomenal actor who you would see, you would recognize from Hollywood stuff, but tons of international stuff too. And a sweetheart and a brilliant actor. So yeah, this has been really great. And the other show I've been doing, which I finished a while ago, but is now starting to air, is it's another alien show, but it's a comedy, Resident Alien.
Yeah.
With my friend Alan Tudyk. So a lot of Vancouver stuff lately.
Nice.
It's been super fun. These two shows and NCIS too, a little bit here and there.
Yeah. And you know Judy's there, right? Sketch.
I didn't know this. You just told me. You had told me in text message like recently.
Yeah. So I'll make sure to put you guys in contact. So if you have some,
please do.
Yeah, we'll definitely do. But let's start at the beginning to find out. So the funny thing is, because you went to NYU, I always think you're from New York, but you're from Cali.
I'm from Northern California.
Yeah.
And because of my name, I think everybody always assumes there's like a... Yeah, because of my name, because of NYU, everybody assumes there's some kind of New York kind of... actually, what's funny is because of my name, when I first got out of school, until casting directors got to know me, it happened a couple times where I went in and I auditioned for something and they said, yeah, we liked him. He was good. He was really talented. He needs to work on his American accent, though. He just needs to... And they were like... And my manager at the time was like, really? How so? And they were like, you know, there was just moments that we could hear his accent popping through, you know, I mean, because somebody said, where's he from? And he said, he's from the States. They're like, no, but where was he born? And he said, California. They're like, no, but where was he like, you know, where was he brought up? And he's like, born, raised, California. And so I said to my manager at the time, I said, listen, I don't speak any other languages. So if I'm speaking weird, then I'm having a stroke. Like, take me to the hospital. You know what I mean? Because if I've got some weird accent. But, you know, it's just the name. I think they were looking for it. They were trying to, like, they just were convinced for some reason that I was foreign born. Well,
you know, we've both been in the industry for a long enough time that shit still happens where they look at you, they're like, but...
Mrs. I think it would happen a lot less these days. When I first came out, like, there was a whole lot of shit where, like, you'd be early days, you're always like kind of doing pre-reads with a casting director. It's almost like an audition before an audition. And someone would come out and they'd be like, They would look at my name on a clipboard and be like, and they would do this chuckle. Like, it would happen all the time. They'd be like, okay, Anver Gagakage, you know? And like, they would always ask me, they're like, so this is what you're going for? This is going to be your stage name? You're just going to like keep it? And I was like, I guess. I mean,
it's my name. Like,
I didn't have like a, I don't know why I stuck with it, but it's
because it's your fucking name.
I don't know. I didn't think about changing it.
I'm personally glad that you didn't, because it's who you are. Like, you say, like, comically, you know this, you say your name now, and people are like, oh yeah, I know that dude, because it's not that it stands out, but it's you.
I just think personally, I wouldn't be able to get used to somebody calling me Evan. You know, you like changed it to you Evan.
Listen, you grew up in California, but you're not an Evan, bro. Like,
I just would never answer to it. Like, I just don't think I would get used to answering to it. But I don't think that would happen today. It's a very different industry. And personally, I think it's a different industry in much better ways.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of new challenges. And I think it's just harder for everybody, top to bottom, to make a buck. But it's... I think there's some things that have changed in terms of people's minds being a little bit more open. That is like, yeah, I don't think they would ever look at your name and like laugh out loud in front of a room full of people. You know what I mean? I think those days are over.
Well, comically, I may have said this on another episode, but I have a story like that where I went in for, my agent called me. They were coming up with something about a shoe product. It was either a new TV show about shoes, it was some fashion something. You know me, I'm big into shoes. I was a fashion designer, everything. So I went in for this and they were looking for a host. And the casting director goes, okay, tell me about the shoe. And I was like, I start talking about the shoe. And she goes, it's great, but don't describe the shoe. Tell me the shoe. And I'm like, all right. So I look at the shoe and I'm like,
I love this.
Yeah. And then I go on again because I'm like, all right, the shoe, like blah, blah, blah. She's like, I don't feel that you're being real with me. I just went, and it just so happened that the camera guy was another black guy. And I looked at him and he just, so, and I was like, are you fucking kidding me? So I just go as street as I can. I'm like, yo, this shoe's the bomb, is blah, 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 blah. She goes, yes, that's great. That's what I'm looking for. And I literally went, fuck you. Never call me again. Like, I don't care who you are. I don't care what you cast. Don't ever call me again. It was just like, I wasn't black enough for her to sell a shoe. And I was like,
have you ever seen that Key and Peele episode where it's like one of them's British and one's actually from Brooklyn? And the British guy, the director keeps going to the British guy. And he's being like, perfect. And then he goes to the guy from Brooklyn. And he's like, I just am not feeling it.
You know? Yeah, that was me.
I felt like that Key and Peele nailed that episode so well. It's like, because, you know, I think in a lot of, casting directors have done like so much, in ways, a lot more than anybody for my career. Mm. But you have to understand that casting directors are like gatekeepers, you know what I mean? And so, you know, they're really like, in a lot of ways, gatekeeping a lot of things and really when somebody chooses all the paintings,
curate
is the word I'm looking for. Yes, they are curating what you see and the options that a director even gets to choose from that have been pre-curated. And so I think, again, I'm really glad to see that that's opened up a lot. I think, I hope so. I don't know. I never did well with commercial stuff, with the commercial auditions or anything like that. I remember I think the last one I had, because I'm a little bit of a germaphobe. I walked in and they were like, it's for like some like a body spray thing. And I walk in and there's a stool and an old sweater. And they're like moving you through, you know, they're trying to like get you through and out as fast as possible. So this woman, God bless her, just doing her job. This woman's like, okay, great. So what you're going to do, it's for this. You're going to come in, you're going to grab the sweater, you smell, rub it all over your face. And you know, it's just something that you smell, you love it. and action. And she's already pushed the button. And I was like, sorry, have you been using this sweater all day? And she's like, yeah. And I was like, so everybody's been putting their face on this sweater. Can I just, how about I just kind of like pretend I'm wiping it on my face? And she's like, you know, she makes a big motion out of like turning the camera off and being like, I'm sorry, what? And I was like, well, if everybody's been rubbing this sweater on their face all day, I just prefer not to. Can I just, how about I mime it? I'll just mime it. And she's like, nobody else has had a problem with rubbing a sweater on their face. It's just rub it on your face and snip it. It's just, it's a commercial. And I just was like, yeah, I have a problem, unfortunately, with rubbing a sweater on my face. That, and I didn't say this, but that 5,000 people have thrown all, like rubbed their face on. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And so, yeah, I just was like, yeah, this might not be for me, you know?
And this was pre-corona era. This is in the 2000s, bro.
Oh, yeah. Dude, if you want to talk about awkward auditions, like I won't even go down this road because the stuff I've been asked to do in an audition. Okay, I'll tell you one more, but I'm not going to go down this road.
Okay.
I went in
we
for...
We got time. Listen, I've got nothing but time.
I went in for a TV show that will not remain named, will not be named. And a lot of times they'll give you an audition and it's like three pages and there's almost no lines. It's all action.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see, and it's like, you know, and I just thought, okay, they don't want you to actually do it. You know, you'll kind of just say the lines and do it all seated. And I get there and she's like, well, and I said, well, you don't want to actually like mime all this, I'm sure, you know? And she's like, no, we want you to do as much as you can possibly do. And I'm like, and the scene was, somebody comes in, they're talking, the person, my character realizes that the person is on to me. So I pull a gun out and I say, move, you know? And then we walk out and then they get to their front door. I say, open it. And they open the front door. We cross the street. They get to the next door. I'm like, ring the bell. They ring the bell. We go inside. There's another couple inside the other house. They're like, what the heck is happening? And I'm like, sit down. You know, it was like all action. Made no sense to do for an audition.
You're doing this by yourself?
And it didn't occur to me for a second. I was a young actor. It didn't occur to me for a second that they were actually going to make me mime the whole thing. So I'm like, okay. And she's like, action. And I'm like, I start doing it all. And I made it about halfway across the street in the world of the audition. You know, I'm like, you know, I'm doing this. And I'm like, and I kind of like did this thing where I just like, I lost my steam halfway through. And I just was like, I looked up at the person. I said, I don't think I can do this. And they were like, what are you talking about? It's great. You're doing great. And I just said, like, I think maybe that's all I got for today. Because it was so bad. I mean, I would give any amount of money to find that audition and like, you know, and just see me kind of calculating internally, like, what the, I mean, what am I doing? Like, what am I doing? So I've had a bunch of auditions where I've just bailed in the middle and just been like, I don't think I got what it takes for this.
Yo, calling out Gamble's network. If any of my friends in casting by chance know what audition he's talking about and you have footage of it, please forward it along.
I think there was a mind knife at some point. It was so wonderful. I would give any amount of money to see that. Like it would.
But at the same time, it's like, at least give you one person to play off of. Like, normally you would like, you want me to do all this action miming with no one in the room. I don't know. At least for a theater, there's typically someone that you read against. There's someone, like, there's something that you can play off of.
You know, I have a lot of sympathy. I mean, there's no thing about it. It's so easy to make fun of the casting process because there's just so many awkward moments that actors have had, but it's the best of the worst options. Like there's no great alternative to it. You know, And so I don't want to sit here because it's almost like an easy target, you know, but the truth of the matter is it's like, you know, they're just doing what the producers told them. They're like, you know, and yeah, the producers are like, this is the audition scenes. This is what we want to see. Then, I mean, what are they going to say? No, you know? And so I do now with some distance, I think it's absolutely hilarious. I love these stories. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It's not like you're sitting here bashing the industry. You're just sharing some awkward early acting moments of auditions. Oh, that was a lot of alliteration. Oh, yeah. Awkward. Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
So let's go back to growing up in Northern Cali and the name Jokaj, because your dad is Albanian, correct?
Yeah. Yes. Albanian from Montenegro. The Albanian diaspora is really interesting. I didn't realize until I went over and visited. But a Montenegrin Albanian is slightly different from an Albanian Albanian, which is different from a Kosovar Albanian. And basically, the short version is, without getting into the history, is it's a World War II border thing where a bunch of British people went in and were like, yeah, let's make some countries here, with no regard to like where the actual indigenous population was.
Oh, never heard that story before.
Yes. So he is a Montenegrin Albanian. My mom's family is originally from the South. So, you know, very, you know, Protestant type of, European descent. I mean, although I guess, you know, Albanian is also technically European. But yeah, so that was how the name came about. That's why my last name is not Robinson. It's Jokaj. Born in Southern California, raised in Northern California, and actually Hawaii for a little bit. So, you know, it's not, when I was first in New York and doing casting and stuff, it's like, it definitely threw people for a loop. You know, they look at me and they're like, oh, young Italian guy from New York. And I think that was like, when I first got out of school, that was like, every fifth role in a show was a young Italian guy. Now you don't see it as much anymore. That was their idea of diversity 10 years ago. You know, it's like, oh, we'll have somebody Italian on the show.
Well, you know, they, for most Swedish actors for a while were playing Russians. And then most Latin Americans were playing Arabic, like Middle Eastern people. And then like it was never really whoever was like what they were playing. It was always some like, but you're from how? Okay. You look the part. All right.
Yeah. I mean, people had no real consideration for that stuff. I think people are, you know, much more sensitive to that now, but, at the time, I mean, geez, I mean, and then looking back into like the 60s and stuff, what character actors used to get away with, you know what I mean?
Mickey Rourke?
What did Mickey, I don't know. Mickey Rooney.
Mickey Rooney. Yeah.
Mickey Rooney. Yeah. I didn't know anything about like Mickey Rourke, but.
No, Mickey Rooney.
I don't know what he did. It's wild, but, when I got out of school, actually, I was more of a character actor. And that was an interesting transition when it was just kind of like, oh, wait, now you really need to be the thing that you're playing. You know, you can't, you know, it's, authenticity is really important, you know, and so as it should be. But it definitely for people who are playing my first job, the show called Dollhouse, I played, I don't know, something like 10 different characters in 2 seasons. I don't even know if that would fly anymore. You know, I don't even know if you're really allowed to do that anymore.
Well, so with Dollhouse as well, that was actually part of the thing. Like you were, it wasn't like
they had a sci-fi premise. So that maybe would have made it slightly okay. But
I see what you're saying.
Regardless, after Dollhouse, I definitely felt like, that's when the industry changed. And I came out thinking like, great, now everybody can see that I'm an awesome character actor. And the industry was like, cool, but that's not what we're doing anymore. So it's it was tough. But yeah, I digress. Northern California.
No, dude, there's no digression. It's your life. Your life doesn't have a linear quality. There's things that happen here, there, and everywhere. But this is news to me. Is it news to me? The Hawaii thing. How long were you in Hawaii?
We lived there for about 4 years when I was a kid, and my natural mother lives there now, full time. She's been there for years and years. And so, I had a little stint. I did a stint in Hawaii.
That's probably could have used that when on the casting. We're like, he's from North Carolina. Oh, he's Hawaiian. Oh, Jokai, I get it. It's cool. Yeah, that makes sense.
I had a tough time in Hawaii because like it was weird because in Northern California with our names, like we were very much like, ooh, like who are you? And then in Hawaii, like we lived in this little neighborhood, which at the time was pretty rough, called Palolo Valley. And we were three little white kids and we got our ass beat. Like it was not really a place. Yeah, no, it was tough. So I did not like Hawaii as a kid. As an adult, wonderful paradise, you know. As an elementary school student, like it did feel like, you know, a stint in prison. I hated it.
What got the family over there?
My mom, I can say this now because she's successful and doing really great. And but my mom at the time went over there for rehab, and so she went over there to get clean and sober. And then we went over there to join her. So it was a tough time. It was a really tough time. And it was like an unstable time. Everything was very like, what's going on? What's happening? You know?
Yeah.
So, but I'm really happy to have, you know, like with anything, you know, it's like a hardship when you're young and you get older and you realize, wow, what a gift, you know, because I was able to, experience, you know, what I would call real Hawaii, you know, which is, you know, that, which was really beautiful. And it was there was moments that were really gorgeous about it, but also to experience, you know, a completely different, like a completely different culture and a completely different way of being from this tiny small town in Northern California where I was living, you know, and to be exposed to, you know, the difficulties that, you know, of being on an island where basically the United States took their queen, and not even the United States, even really like businesses like Dole Pineapple and, you know, large business interests took over an entire island. And then to kind of like, to get that experience of like, oh, this is also America. You know what I mean? And this is what's going on in America. And these are like the ramifications of it, you know? I'm really grateful for that experience now to realize, you know, to not have been raised in a completely hermetically sealed environment for my whole life, you know?
How was it with, how was it for your brothers? Because you have two brothers, one older, one twin. Beckham and Demon.
Yeah, Bekim and Demir. Yeah. It was tough. My brother was like, you know, he got real tough and he got involved with like these little kind of like gangs, you know, whatever you call gangs in middle school, you know, but kids doing stupid shit. And it was heavy, man. Like my mom was also, you know, on and off again on drugs. So it was like, I can say this now because everybody's happy, everybody's in a good place and healed about the whole thing. I'm really happy. Like we had to develop skills at a young age. Like, you know, my mom would be working and she did, she worked very hard. We had to learn how to cook for ourselves, you know, at a very young age. It's like, you know, cooking and cleaning. And at a certain, there was a long period of time where we were even earning money. And like, there was a lot of times when we were scavenging fruit from trees and shit, you know, it made us grow up in a way and become self-sufficient mm-hmm. in a way that, that I don't think like a lot of young people are asked to. And, you know, when that happens, when you're like a free range child in that way, sometimes some really fucked up shit can happen, you know, excuse my language, but
some, no, you're good.
You know,
I dropped it already.
Doesn't, you know, if, you know, I mean, I hesitate to think about the ways that we could have been, you know, abused or hurt, but thank God we weren't. And like when you're lucky enough to be in a free range parenting environment where nothing truly bad happens to you like that, mm-hmm. then I can look back on it now and be like, oh, that was great, you know, because I was kind of thrown in over my head and we all were kind of, you know, just, you know, trying to figure things out. And I look at later times in life when I had a lot of drive and when I just was like thrown in over my head and figuring things out, I didn't realize until much later in life that there's people who don't know how to do that. You know,
yeah.
they're just like, oh, what do? I don't know how to do this. And I really credit like some of those years in my childhood with kind of like helping me figure that out.
I have a really dumb question. What was it like growing up with a twin? Do you have that psychic connection that they always talk about?
It's not psychic, but it's wonderful, first of all. And he's my best friend, like 100%. When we were young, actually, like it was really frustrating because my older brother got his own room, got all the new clothes, he got everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he was also a big squeaky wheel. So he got like a lot of the attention too. You know, and so like anybody who has to fight over resources, like we clashed a lot. And he was always very different from me. We looked identical. To this day, we look fairly identical. But back then, we were just indistinguishable. But we were always personality-wise extremely different. And we weren't some people are twinsy twins. There's some weird twins. You know, they like to hold hands and shit. You know what I mean? We were never the twinsy twins. Like we were always very like, if I was wearing one thing, he would wear another. If his hair was cut a certain way, my head, you know, we were from a young age, we're distinguishing ourselves from each other. Mm. But then actually what's weird is like, you know, by the time we were in high school, we were fighting a lot. We were really, because we had to share a car, we had to share a room. I mean, after like your whole lifetime of sharing a room, like, I mean, fuck, when we were young, we had to share a bed at times, you know?
Yeah.
And like older than when you should have been sharing a bed, you know, with with somebody, mostly because of money issues. But like, you know, eventually, like by high school, we were getting in fights. And then he went to a different college and I went to Berkeley. And then about a year after he went to, he came and visited me and my friend there. And then he transferred. He was like, this is way better. And he transferred. And from then on, we've just been as close as you can be, you know? We just needed 1 year of not being forced to share fucking everything.
Yeah, no.
I really blame my parents. And I tell people when they have twins, I'm like, please, give them their own things. You know, don't make them dress alike. You know what I mean? Don't do that, you know? You know, don't treat them like a half of a whole. We used to, it happened all the time. My brother would get a gift that would say the Kim. Mm-hmm. And then we would get one gift that said the twins, you know?
Oh.
And like, or cards with money, you would get $20 and we would get $10 a piece. I mean, like, oof. Like, and I think that was the tension between us. Like once we were old enough that he could have his own apartment and I could have my own stuff, we've just been inseparable ever since. We talk every single day.
You know? As you said, he's your best friend. But you know, like,
it's like, you know what I tell people? It's like everybody else is on a dial-up connection, even with your best friend in the world. You guys are on maybe DSL. But Demir and I, it's like cable modem. It's like fiber optic, right? It's like if you ever were uncomfortable in a party and you could just clone yourself to laugh at your own jokes, just to be that person who gets it 100%, who's like on your wavelength and gets it. That's what it's like for me to have a Twitter.
By the way, I think you completely just totally dated yourself by using dial-up, DSL, and cable fiber optics as your No, there's a whole generation of us in our generation that completely understands that. We're like, oh, I know what you're talking about. But they're also going to laugh because, like, who uses that as a reference anymore? But there are going to be some people like...
I had this rule when I was dating before I met my partner. I had this rule that if you didn't know who Holland Oates were, and that if you had a high school a cell phone in high school, that I probably couldn't date you. Not because you were too young. I don't want to say anything about maturity level. There's plenty of people who were much more mature than me. But it just, to me, that was a sign that it was too much. Like, it's just a different experience of the world. You know what I mean? There's too much that I would be referencing that you would never understand.
Hey, just so you know, I'm slightly older than you, and I had a cell phone in high school.
What are you talking about? You had a cell phone. It would have been beepers in high school. Who had cell phones in high school? There were the bricks back when I was in high school.
I didn't say it was a fucking iPhone. I said I had a cell phone. It was a Motorola StarTech is what I had, and I had a beeper. And no, I wasn't dealing drugs. I was just as busy as I am now. Yeah.
Dude, you were a baller, man. Who were you calling? Like... nobody else in high school, not your friends.
Well, the thing is, I had a beeper, so if people would, and I had a car, so if people would like beat me, I would have to call back to find out who it was, what they wanted, or like my family, like, hey, where are you? Or something like that. Damn. But because I was, just like I am now, I was student council president, senior class president. I was a tri-sport athlete, and I was working. So as you said.
Yeah, and you were also the guy who was like, you know, you see those, what is it, Royal Tenenbaums, where the kids have the brick phones and they're doing deals. Or like Ben Stiller's character when he's young, he's like doing deals and like reading the output from the, you know, the or whatever.
Dude, I was known for my planner that was about like this thick of just like information and dates and meetings and stuff like that. Yeah, I was that kid.
Totally tracks.
Yeah. So yeah, I had a cell phone, bro. I had a brick and a beeper. I was popular. Leave me alone. It's not about me. We're talking about you.
I miss those days, man. I really do. There's no going back, and I believe me, I'm as addicted as anybody. If I leave I just walked into the supermarket the other day, and I was like, I literally had a moment where I was like, what happened? And I realized my cell phone, I left it in my car, you know? But it's like, I mean, now if I'm even without my cell phone for like 30 minutes, you know, it's all of us, I guess, but when I went to college, man, the whole time I was at Berkeley, very few people had cell phones. And there was this thing that happened like on a Friday. People don't understand. Like, you would spend entire days looking for your friends and never find them, right? So on a Friday night, you'd be like, you know, you'd get out of a class, you'd sit there in the quad. Usually you'd see your friends, but if you miss them, you go home and call somebody's house. They're not there. Call another house. Go to where you usually hang out and drink. Not there. That would be an entire Friday night, maybe an entire weekend, right? Just like constantly missing your friends.
Yeah.
And that was it. You just go home and you'd be like, well, that was my whole night. And it sucked sometimes and it was super frustrating, but like there was also these like this kismet type of things where like could happen, right? Where you would go and you would look for somebody and you wouldn't find them, but you would find somebody else or you would make a new friend. Now I think you just, what's sad is like, I think in this world we're in right now, you tend to get the expected. You tend to get exactly what you expect.
Instant gratification.
So you don't just go out with your friends and then you see some, you know, person across the room and you're like, wow, that person's so attractive or whatever. You know already. You already matched with that person. In fact, to go and talk to somebody you haven't matched with already is almost like a faux pas. People are like, Jesus Christ, I'm in the supermarket. I'm just trying to buy some vegetables. Back off, you know? That was the only way you met people before, you know? And there was flaws with it, but I do miss some of the things.
Yeah, it was, I think that's why our generation is so resourceful, because we lived a stalker life. Like, we had to stalk our friends to find them. Like, I clearly remember driving around town, as you said, if they're not at this house or at this house, are we at this place where we normally meet up? Where's everybody? All right, cool. I'll find another group of friends, not another group of friends, but I'll look for the next group that I can find. Like, it's so now, because I was going to ask you this as well about phones. Remember living in LA where we had the Thomas Guide, where you learned how to get around town through a map that was, it wasn't just one map. It was a book of like 600 pages. And in order for you to find out where you needed to go, you had to connect A1 on page 92 to D4 on page 136.
And sometimes you'd be driving, you have to pull over and you have to be like, oh my God, what the hell? Yeah. I do remember that.
And people nowadays have no clue how to navigate without Google Maps or Apple Maps or whatever thing that they're using. Oh, and that's the other thing. We had MapQuest, which was like a choose your own adventure type app where it would literally drive you to a deserted road or a highway that doesn't exist.
Oh, I remember that too. I forgot about that. You would print out all your directions before you went. So you have this little like, yeah. And it was wrong half the time.
It was wrong half the time. And then you had to navigate around where you were and like, okay, this street looks familiar. Okay. Yeah. So we had a whole thing.
Well, you know, I'm not one of those people. I think technology is awesome. I think, I'm not one of those kind of like rose colored glasses type of person where it's like, oh, it was so much better. But I will say like, I get choice anxiety very easily. You know, if I go to a restaurant and there's like more than three pages on the menu, I'm like, oh God, I'm going to have a freak out. I'm going to have a panic attack. You know, like I don't want to have to. And there's this study, there's an interesting study that they did. I'm probably going to misquote it, but they went and they, what is it? They were selling people three different varieties of jam, right? Mm-hmm. And they also had a separate arm of this study where they sold people like 10 varieties of jam. And they followed up with the person afterwards to say, like, okay, how happy were you with your choice? And in this study, and it had nothing to do with the jam. It was just a, you know, a pretext for the study, like a sociological study. The people who were the least happy with it, people, if you ask them, would you be happier with more choices and fewer choices? Everybody said, I'll be happier with the 10 choices, right? But without exception, almost, the people who are happier after the fact with their decisions are the people who only had three choices, who only had a limited amount of choices. And it's this thing called choice anxiety. And I have it all the time, right? Where it's like, there's too many options. Mm-hmm. Now I know too much. And one of the things I think we were lucky about with my childhood is like, I mean, we had to deal with boredom, but I didn't have to deal with a lot of choice anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. Even in terms of what you're watching, I remember I used to watch, like we used to rent from Blockbuster and you'd have it the whole weekend.
Yeah.
But we didn't have TV. We didn't have reception where I grew up in Northern California. So we would watch that one movie on repeat. And if you bought a movie, forget about it. Like I could quote the movie like the Bible, you know, because it was like one of 20 movies that we would watch all the time. So like, you know, I know every single frame of that movie, and the things now are just like so much more digestible. You know, I don't know anybody who's like really rewatching these TV shows, you know, like, or anything like that. It's like you watch it, you watch the season, everybody's on to the next thing.
Right.
You know?
But that's what I mean about that's what I mean. You said earlier, but I quoted it as instant gratification, that everybody wants everything right here, right now, and then move on to the next. Even with dating, there's no one knows how to communicate anymore because it's, swipe left, swipe right. I like you. Oh, we match. Oh, we don't. Okay, great. On to next. And even committing, I don't know if this is a thing in the US, but in Sweden, no one really commits to dates anymore. They're like, yeah, maybe we can meet like next Wednesday. Oh, you know what? Sorry, because they're waiting for something better to come along. They'll just, it's not even choice anxiety. It's, they're just waiting for the next best thing.
Cherry picking.
Yeah.
It was cherry picking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's weird. I'm kind of divided because in a lot of ways I feel like people, I was watching a reality show.
Why were you doing
that? And I was like, man, this, because my partner's got me totally addicted to reality TV. I'm open. Like, not happy with this latest season of Love is Blind, but otherwise am totally a watcher. We watch a lot of South Korean reality TV, believe it or not, that I'm addicted to. But you know, it's so interesting. Even on a reality TV show, I heard somebody say something. The level of communication was amazing. Instead of saying like, you did this, you did that. They were saying something like, what I felt you were communicating was this, or what I received was this. I was like, we wouldn't have said that shit back in the day. that's new. That's a higher level of communication. And if and the level of communication on a TV show, on a reality TV show, is very poor. You know, it's people when they're really triggered. But if that's what I'm seeing, I think the bottom has risen a little bit. But I do agree with you. There's choice anxiety, right? And when you can always go on an app, you know, I met my partner on an app, but I had a horrible time before then, you know. You know, I always tell my friends who are doing the dating scene. An older actor told me one time. He said, being in the business, it's like a game that you can lose a million times. You only need to win once, right? So the feeling is that you should be kind of like stepping up. There should be some upward trajectory. Mm-hmm. I didn't experience that with dating. It was like nothing, 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 bam, right? And but it's definitely difficult. And it's this feeling of powerlessness when like, you know, at least when you could go out and meet somebody in person, you could do something about it. You could join a, you know, play frisbee golf and you could meet somebody. It's so powerless when you're like matching with people, but then never following through or never getting into a phone call or anything like that. It was really, yeah, I didn't have an easy time of it. I literally, here's the thing. People would always, when I wasn't on those apps, if you asked me, like, what do you think your potential is for finding a partner? I'd be like, yeah, hey, it's pretty good. You know, I think I'll find somebody. I think I'll be happy. About a week after I got on the app, I'd be like, I'm going to be alone forever. I'm never finding anybody. Like, for some reason, as soon as I got on the app, I was just like, I am, my feeling about my prospects has gone through the floor. You know, it just makes you feel worthless. I mean, it made me feel worthless.
Oh, wow.
You know?
So do you feel that there was a difference before and after your career, quote unquote, took off in the dating pool? Do you feel like there was a pressure or a...
No, because I think the secret's out. Because I was dating a lot in LA and the secret is out, you know, when it comes to actors. I felt like it hurts you a lot being an actor for a lot of, I think, perfectly understandable reasons, you know, like... you know, as actors can be narcissistic and delusional. You know? So I actually never blamed somebody. There was a bunch of conversations that as soon as they either I told them or they found out that I was an actor, it was like, that was just the end of the conversation completely. I don't know if it would have been the same in a different town, but I think in LA, the secret is out that actors can be a little bit very interesting.
Interesting is a good way to put that.
I didn't find it helped me at all, actually.
No, I didn't think it helped you. I thought it worked against you. That you
oh,
were
not. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It definitely worked against me.
Like, no. I was. No.
The person that wanted to date an actor wanted to date a more famous actor than me. And the person who didn't want an actor didn't want to date me. And so I was kind of like in the center of the donut hole where it's like, kind of neither here nor there for a lot of people.
Yeah. That's what I meant by, was it easier before or after your career took off? Like that, because there is a prestige of, one, you not wanting people to find out that you're an actor, because then is it that they're trying to date you because you're an actor? Or then like you said,
my career has honestly never been at a point where I worried, or at least I haven't felt. I've never worried that somebody was a friend or dating me because of my like notoriety. I'm really happy with the level that I've worked. I'm beyond happy. And I think I actually inhabit a very lucky kind of niche in this industry where I still get to have my privacy and I don't have to look around. I don't make the kind of money and I don't have the kind of fame and notoriety that I have to worry about the people around me being like, are they with me for my private jet? That's never, ever been a worry for me. Thankfully, you know.
So rewind a little bit. We come back from Hawaii. We're back in Northern California. Did we play sports? Did we do theater? Did we do music? Like, what got us on the trajectory to go to Berkeley and NYU? Like, what?
I was doing, I was also class president and, I was a really interesting, I think, kid at that time because I was I was not popular by any means. And I was a little withdrawn in some ways and like angry, but super focused and driven school-wise. You know, I think I took a lot of kind of some early childhood trauma and focused it in kind of a positive way, or was positive at that time. I was doing everything. I was doing sports, but I was obsessed. I knew at a young age, and maybe this is a better way to approach this conversation. I knew very young that I was going to live in a big city and I was not going to live. Immediately when I was in this small town that I grew up in, I was like, I'm never staying here. And so I was laser focused on whatever I needed to do to get into a good college, because to me, that just meant that I was going to go to some city somewhere that was not in the town that I lived in, you know? And that's all I cared about. And so a lot of the stuff I was doing was just extracurricular activities to make me look good on paper. But I did like acting. I got injured in soccer, as you hear from a lot of people who are actors. You know, they were playing sports, they got injured. And this was something that I could do. And we had a great little program where I was at in my high school. Never occurred to me that I would do it after high school. Mm-hmm. And I got into Berkeley for computer science. Did not continue with that. But I mean, yeah, once upon a time, I was halfway decently or academically smart.
that was going to be horrible timing. I was going to say that's news to me, but I meant that the computer science degree was news to me, not that you were academically
focused. No, but I didn't get a computer science degree. I very quickly was like, this is not for me. Like, yeah. this is not a personality fit for me. But I didn't, it didn't occur to me that I would do it even in college. And there was like a, Berkeley wasn't a place that you went to be an actor. It wasn't like a known undergrad program at the time. I don't know how it's doing now. And so I went there and I did a couple extracurricular kind of things, in the theater department. And that's where I kind of felt like it was the first time people treated me like, oh, you're good at this. You could do this, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it was, but even then, even as young as I was and knowing as little as I knew about the industry, I just had an instinct that the world was not asking for more actors. You know what I mean? I just knew. I'm like, yeah, maybe I'm okay. But it's the world is not clamoring for more actors. You know what I mean? Like, I just So I was doing it and I was having fun, but I was also like, no, I'm not going to do this professionally. And then I think the turning point was a teacher of mine, Laura Dolis. Laura, thank you very much. This wonderful woman who I just had a sense was not bullshitting me. It's a lot of people who are in acting training and in these programs. They don't do you a service, right? They're just telling everybody, do it. Pursue your dreams. Do whatever you want. And they collect all your money and then they like open a door and like fucking throw you out into the wolf, you know, to the wolves, you know? That's not, I don't think you're doing a service to somebody by not preparing them for how tough the industry is. And this woman was not doing that. I could see from her classes that she was giving it to people straight. And she told me, she's like, I really think that you should audition for NYU, Yale, and Juilliard. They did auditions. You could pay $50 and audition for all of them at once in San Francisco at ACT. You know, she's like, I really think you should do this. And I was like, well, you know, I want to do another year at Berkeley. I don't have enough credits to graduate yet, but you know what? I'll do it this year. It's $50. It'll be a cool experience. And I'll get practice for next year when I really want to audition. So I auditioned and I got accepted by all three. And then I was like, oh. You have to do a callback for NYU. But I did eventually get accepted to all three. And that was the first time in my life when I felt like, oh, like maybe I am a little bit more than a big fish in a small pond. You know what I mean? Maybe there is something to this. And so that was kind of the turning point. That was the first time that I ever actually considered professionally acting in my life. And even then, I ended up going to NYU. I got a scholarship and I was like, yeah, it probably won't work out, but I want to go to New York anyway. So I'll just go and I'll do this program. It won't cost me that much. And then maybe I'll go do a business degree afterwards. You know, I never was, you know, no offense to people who are gung-ho and they knew when they were a kid, you know, but I never was 100% on it until I was professionally acting, you know? Mm.
What was it in high school that got you to Berkeley, aside from the computer science, but you played football. Berkeley's not a big football school. I know you said you got soccer. Soccer.
Yeah.
Sorry, I live in Sweden now, so it's in my...
Yes.
Soccer, my bad.
I don't want to get out of like embarrassed that he was a football player. Never played football. Never played football.
No. The sport where you kick the ball with your foot, that football, soccer.
Yes.
Like, but what was there another sport? Like how, what was the, what got you from high school?
Just like good grades. I was a grade shark. Mm. I was like, that was my biggest thing. I think if I had a personality at all in high school, I was a grade shark. I was determined got a bad score on the SAT and I took it another, I think, two times. I just was determined. I'm a really bad test taker. I'm a horrible test taker. So, I was just determined to get into a good school.
All right. But then you get into this good school. The program's like, nah. So why did you want to do another year at Berkeley? What were you going to do another year of? Because you weren't happy.
I just didn't have the credits to graduate in time. And so when I did get into NYU, when I did decide to go to NYU, I had to take a final semester. I basically had to, it was almost impossible to get enough credits in to graduate in time. I mean, I barely did it.
So you did the full 4-year program.
I did 4.5. I ended up having to take summer school and just like take as many credits as they would let me get in order to graduate in time because I didn't know if the scholarship wouldn't transfer that to a year.
Okay.
From then. So I just had to kind of, you know, bust ass but I wasn't planning on it. I was planning on taking a whole another year.
So what degree did you get?
I ended up getting an English major. It was the thing that by the time I
from Berkeley or from NYU?
From Berkeley.
Okay.
It was the closest route to me graduating. So okay. At that time, I was like, oh, I literally went and I talked to the counselor. I'm like, I need to get out of here. I need to go to grad school in New York. How do I graduate? And he said, we just worked it out. We worked backwards from there. We were like, okay, here's how you get enough credits to graduate. There was no rhyme or reason. I had no idea what I wanted to do when I was, you know, when I was an undergrad.
Did the English... English degree, quote unquote, the classes that you took to get that degree end up helping you with your degree at NYU? Like, did it come in handy at all? Like any of the learned?
No, I think, you know, I look back and this is my criticism that I have, even for like NYU, for example, which is much more focused than the undergraduate degree. A kid doesn't know that when they're going into something, that they're spending all this money and there's like zero possibility of recouping that money ever, right? In the professional world. And yet you're asking that kid to sign on the dotted line to have debt for the rest of their life. It should 100% be illegal. Like it should 100%, if this was like selling cars and somebody was like, oh, we're going to sell you a car and there's no way of knowing whether or not this car works. We have laws. That's illegal. You can't do that. So it's a lemon law. You know what I mean? They're selling lemons left and right in like higher education. I loved Berkeley too. I loved it. I had an idyllic experience and things turned out okay for me. But I was the exception to the rule, you know? And I even though I got a scholarship, I ended up taking out a lot of loans for NYU. And they know. Like they understand full well that I went to NYU grad, so our incoming class was, I think 13 people in each class, or was it more? No, I think it was 13 and 13. So I think it was like 26, somewhere between 20 and 26 for each class. Mm-hmm. Even those small numbers, they know that maybe 2 out of the 20 are going to have a professional career.
All right.
When you're running those numbers, you cannot be asking people to pay that much money. You know what I mean? It's absolutely criminal, I think, you know? Mm-hmm. And now just because it worked out for me and I was, I am working professionally, doesn't mean that my classmates weren't totally fucking ripped off. You know what I mean? And so I just think, I won't go down that road. I do think higher education needs to, Malcolm Gladwell has an amazing podcast about this, about higher education. He does like a major takedown. I think it's a 3-part series on his podcast about how useless higher education is. And so I won't go into it. He said it better. Go watch that.
Yeah. Well, I don't really need to. I lived it myself. I gained most of my experience in the real world, and my degree is not in performing arts. My degree is I also didn't get it, but my degree is in fashion design and merchandising and marketing, advertising, communications. I did work in advertising. I decided really early that I wasn't going to do fashion design because same thing. I'm never going to work for someone who's going to get creative credit and all the money for something that I created with my name not attached. Like this jacket I could have designed, but it's for Nike. So Nike gets all the, no, not going to do that. But everything else that I did, I got all of my experience from actually being in the working world. Like it wasn't what I learned.
Right.
It wasn't what I studied.
Right. And you could say, oh, but there's a liberal arts education. All of your, your requirement courses give you a liberal arts education. Everything that I learned about rhetoric that I eventually ended up learning as an actor to help me as an actor, like break down scripts, understand what's going on. Like the most, like I guarantee you most college students, if you asked them even a basic question about rhetoric, about, false argumentation, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like, can you read this? And identify the argumentative fallacies. You know what I mean? Can you understand like what it is that is like something that sounds truthy, but is actually not logically or rhetorically correct, you know? Mm-hmm. I found that out. I taught myself that way after college. I didn't learn that in undergrad or in grad school. So it's like the basic things that we should be teaching kids, you know, they're reading Huckleberry Finn. Great. But what do we need to know? Like, we need to be able to listen to a podcast and be like, well, hey, that person is very, you know, charismatic and persuasive.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make a statement true. True. Yep. Right. And like, people don't understand. And we're about to go into this AI driven world where like generating a false article or generating false content or that sounds correct, is going to be easy as a push of a button, right? Mm-hmm. But none of us have the tools of being able to look at it and be like, hold on a second, that sounds right, but let me just break this down and figure out like, oh, okay, this is why rhetorically this is not correct or logically this is incorrect, right?
Yeah.
And so I don't even think that flies. You know what I mean? Like,
well, it's also because the US higher education system, again, as you said, you don't test well. That's what it's based on. It's based on exams. And the exams aren't essentially practical information. They're loaded with information that you have to study in order to pass the assessment of if you remember this, not if you know it, but if you remember this information or not.
Well, it's kind of like, to tie this back in, it's kind of like audition, right? And casting directors. It's a necessary evil. We just don't. And so not having a degree, is worse for you than having a useless degree, right? And so end of the day, we all know that most of these degrees that these colleges are offering are a total sham, you know? But it's better than getting out into the work world and not having a degree. I think there could be a moment in our lifetime, it could happen tomorrow, if employers collectively decided, you know, let's say all the top five tech companies just across the board, all decided, you know what, we are making it, you know, illegal for our HR department to consider your higher education at all in their hiring decision. It's not even going to be included, right? I think that could tip the boards where all of a sudden everything would just go out the window. You know what I mean? I think colleges would go bankrupt. Like half the colleges in the United States would go bankrupt overnight because they're not really offering like value to to society and to their students. They're really just kind of rubber stamping us, you know?
Well, again, I know you didn't want to go down this route. We're here anyway, but that's part of the thing with unis is that there's that piece of paper has become such an idolized thing that doesn't guarantee you a job. But we're taught and conditioned to know that without this, you can't get anywhere. Where instead of teaching people, you should learn a refined skill. You should have something that, I don't know, plumbing, electrician, like a vocational skill or something. Well, it could be performing arts, like something that's a skill that this paper, because what is it? 50% of freshman undergrads change their major by the time they're a second year.
It's like, insane to ask a kid to know what they're going to do. Like, you know,
right.
I like pause for somebody out there who might be watching this and like for some insane reason, taking advice from an actor,
an actor and a choreographer. Right.
I want to just say like, I don't live in a world of shoulds. I try to live in the real world, and in the real world, like the studies show that end of the day, your earning potential is still going to be linked to a college degree. Now, I think there's all these ways in which when you're in a fast-changing society, we can see that a certain thing is no longer going to be take us into the future, but there's no alternative that's better yet, right? I think, unfortunately, when the new alternative has not emerged. So if I had a kid who was going to college today, you know, or like in the next year, I'd probably still send him to college, you know what I mean? Because it would be the best of the worst choices, right? My hope is that in the future, we have a better choice for people, right? Yeah. And like we have a, but I mean, yeah, I mean, I really try not to live in a world of shoulds. You know, I think, should they allow kids to go into so much debt knowing that they'll never recoup that money? I think that shouldn't be the case, but
here we are.
Yeah.
You know, I don't live in that world.
After both of our mutual tirades about the higher education system, we've now graduated NYU grad school for drama.
Yeah, MFA.
Master's in Fine Arts, yes. Where do we go from there?
It's interesting. I mean, I really didn't know if I was going to work. I never really have had an outside job other than like food service, you know? Mm. I thought at the time, well, I'll give this a shot. I will say, man, I super admire in every way the people who get into this industry by, you know, working background as background actor and going to open calls. Like, I was so lucky. I got an agent straight out of the, these kind of like, what do they call it?
The showcases?
These showcases, yes, that they do for all the casting, the big casting directors in New York. I got an agent right away. I started going on auditions right away. Not long after that, about 6 months after I got out of school, I booked my first movie, and like things pretty much happened fairly quickly, not easily, but like I was able to hang on as a professional actor pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. There's people out there who spend years trying to work their way up the system. And I think it's very hard because 2 + 2 never equals 4, you know, when you're doing small roles, you know, right. It's not like a one-liner, like 4 one-liner jobs lead to a bigger role. A lot of times, you know, you just get pigeonholed into that place by a casting director. So for people who came up that way, man, I have the deepest admiration. I was super lucky. I just went right in. And so then I adjusted myself to the idea that, that I was going to have to find a niche. And for me, initially, I was like, okay, I'm going to be, if things go well for me, I'll be a John Turturro type of, you know, New York character actor. So I was really focused on that. And I rode that wave for a little bit. You know, when I met you, I had worst timing ever. I have the worst time ever. Do not take, you know, investing advice from me. Right before the strike, I moved to LA, and then there was a major strike. And then also the 2008 crisis happened.
Right.
Right. So I literally moved to this moment when I'm like, I'm going to go. I've got a few big jobs under my belt. LA, here I come. I couldn't have chosen a worse time. And so when I met you, it was a really tough time in my life. And I was, I had no car and was staying in somebody's living room. And the only place I would go was a bar that I could walk to across the street because I was in LA with no car. And at that bar, that's where I met you. That was your hangout. The woods. Jesus. I'll tell you an interesting story, though. Talk about early years. So that was the first dry period that I ever experienced as an actor where I was like, oh, you know, maybe these jobs that I got straight out of school were just one-offs. Like maybe actually I don't have what it takes. And I'd never had kind of like a serious side job. So I was looking for work, but of course it was the strike. And it was 2008. So every actor was trying to get a job as a bartender. Could not get a job in food service or bartending. And I had auditioned for this Joss Whedon show. But I was dead broke and I was literally on my last couple of dimes. And so I went to the local Coffee Bean right around the block from me. And was getting a coffee with a friend. And the people behind the counter were like kind of rocking out to their own music and like talking to each other. And I was like, I could do this. Like, this looks... And I asked the guy, I was like, how's this job? Is it fun? Like, what does it pay? And he's like, yeah, it's pretty easy. You know, it's easy. It's fun. Everybody here is really cool. And I was like, dude, can I get an application? He's like, yeah, man. He gave me an application. I took it home. I'd already auditioned for the Joss Whedon show, but I filled the whole thing out. And I was like, if this show doesn't pay out, which is crazy because it's like I had been rejected from 100 auditions. So it was like totally normal to be rejected all the time. But I just said, you know, if I don't get a call back for this, then I'm just going to turn this application in. And I remember the day they said, now you're testing for it, you know, and I got it. I got the role. And to celebrate, I went with the guy whose living room I was staying in. He was celebrating with me because he's like, thank God this guy's leaving my house.
That was Eddie, you know? Right?
Eddie Gathegi. Eddie Gathegi. He's doing really well. He went with me and we went to the Coffee Bean. And instead of turning in the application, I got a coffee and I threw the application in the trash. That was like my kind of like, there's no one big break, but that was the break that kind of kept me in the game for many years, you know?
What year did you move to LA? Was that 2008?
2007. Yeah. I think it was 2007. That was when the strike was, the writer's strike.
Seven. Yeah. Yes, you're right. Yeah.
But yeah. And then, did Dollhouse for a couple of years. And then even after Dollhouse, I think actually added the driest period of my career after coming off of Dollhouse, you know, because the industry changed, you know. I mean, I think there was a place for like an Italian looking character actor, you know. I think two things happened. One, I wasn't seeing myself correctly. I thought based on Dollhouse and based on all the stuff that I had done before then, that I was going to be a character actor. And then as I got older, just more and more casting directors were like, you're not that, you know? And I was like, yeah, like I'm like a John Turturro, like a wacky kind of character actor. And like, and I think people were just like, you're not that, but you're not a leading man, you know? So we don't really know where to put you. Right. And so that was tough for me because I just didn't know where I could contribute, like what it was that I was contributing and what I was bringing to the table. You know, I think this is on a higher level. I think one of my problems at that time is, and maybe a problem with every actor, I don't know, but I wasn't asking myself how I could contribute. You know what I mean? I was just obsessed with like, how do I get ahead, you know, and like not seeing the forest through the trees. And I think when things later on started to turn around for me, finally, eventually years later, it was because I changed my attitude because I was so sick and tired of hearing myself complain. And I was sick and tired. I got to the point where I was just hating acting. I hated it. And, I just said to myself, I'm like, dude, then quit. Like, but don't stay in this industry and just keep complaining and like turn negative. You know what I mean? Quit, or you got to find a different way to be. And the different way to be was, to me, I was like, you got to go in there wanting to contribute, you know, something. Like, what am I bringing? What do I offer? Even if what I'm offering is just kind of like fully putting myself out there so that the person can say like, great, love you. This is not what we're looking for. I just had to change my attitude. And I think at the time, I wasn't thinking that way. I wasn't thinking like, okay, well, what is it that I uniquely bring and that I could offer that nobody else can offer to tell a story better, you know? And so it was really hard for me. I don't think, and to complicate things, I think in this industry, probably the most important thing that you can do is something that your parents did. It's just how you look. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, really, do you look like an archetype that people want to use right now to tell stories? Mm-hmm. And it's really hard. It takes a lot of humility for as an actor to admit that. Admit like the number one thing that'll decide whether I'm cast or not is something that has nothing to do with how talented I am or what I do. Literally just like, this is what my look and my vibe is. There's some people when you get out of grad school, they're almost like they come out of the artistic womb fully formed. You know what I mean? Like from get-go, you're like, I know exactly what you're going to get cast as. Like, you're the nerdy guy, the nerdy funny guy. There's a role for you in every fucking movie out there somewhere, right? I can find a role for this guy. There's something about being kind of like not fitting into any kind of defined lines that makes it extremely hard when you're starting out, but advantageous later on. So I know a lot of people who got out of school and it was like, bam, they started working right away because they fit into an archetype so perfectly that they just walked straight into work and then they didn't stop, but they hit a ceiling, right? Because at a certain point, to go to the next level, you have to have something totally unique. And so what hurts you in the beginning can kind of help you in the end. Mm-hmm. But can you make it to the end if you're not working in the middle, right? Like if you can't make a living out of being an actor at all, then you won't be around in 10 years for people to even realize that there's something cool and unique about you. So there's this tension, like you're really trying to hit the center of this Venn diagram of like, I want to be commercial enough that people can hire me and I can work, because I certainly didn't have benefactors in my life who would give me money to survive. You know, if I didn't make my rent every month, that was it, you know? Yeah. So on one hand, you have to be commercial enough to work. On the other hand, you have to be unique enough to not be limited to just being a stereotypical kind of like whatever. And that's really hard, man. I mean, I think there was a good 8 years, you know, that I was struggling with that, trying to figure out, like, I don't even know what characters I'm supposed to play. How is a casting director supposed to know that? You know what I mean? I don't know what I am, you know? And I think the only solution to that was getting older. I'll tell you a funny story. And then I'll shut up.
Please don't.
This guy, Garrett Dillahunt, was my mentor assigned to me at NYU. Brilliant actor. He tells me a story when I get out. He's talking about himself. He's telling me a story. He said, when I got out of school, this casting director told me, he's like, you're not going to work very much until you're probably like late 30s, early 40s, you know? So see if you can survive until then, and you know, maybe then you'll work. And he was like, fuck you, man. How dare you? What are you talking about? And one of his big breakout roles was Deadwood. And he told me, he's like, if I'm honest, I can't remember how old he was, but I think he was 39 when he booked Deadwood. And he's like, if I'm honest with myself, that guy was right. Now I'm listening to this story and I'm thinking like, that's funny. What a great story. And I'm listening to it at like 25, not at all connecting the dots that he's telling me this story for a reason. And then when I was like, kind of like 38, you know, I was like, I think Garrett was telling me that story for a reason. I think he wasn't just telling me an amusing story about his life. I think he was trying to, in a very subtle way, say to me like, buddy, you might be the same. And I think it definitely was the case for me that there was nothing that I could do short of snapping my fingers and being late 30s, early 40s, that was going to make a big difference for me, you know?
There's so many things that you hit for me as well. And what you said, like one of them, with being, you didn't say typecast, but for me, it's being a typecast actor that when I was in LA, I was either going to be the funny black friend or like the gangster. And I was like, no, I have more dynamics to me. I'm not going to be the token black
roles.
What's that?
They're not writing roles for you.
Right.
But they're not writing those roles.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm like, no, yeah. I won't do it. So that's why I actually decided to stay more on the commercial side, because I could be the character actor there without having to be pegged in to a single thing. And there was a lot of commercials that I did where they'd be like, so Mike, we want to try this interstitial. Can you do this for us? And I'm like, why me? Because I'm an actor that can give you the character. Like, I get it. Cool. That's fine. But I decided, I was like, I'm not just going to take whatever I'm given just to appease them, to make me, like you said, work enough to get there and then maybe at the end get to it. But then there was a point where I think I was 27. I was too old to look young and I was too young to look old. And I remember they sent me out for commercial casting as a dad, for a 30-something year old dad. And I actually knew the casting. One of the casting directors at this time said, I'd done a couple commercials with them. And they looked at me and they're like, why are you here? And I'm like, because this is actually my... And I was like, because comically, this is actually my age range. She goes, and she looked at the other actors and looked at me. She goes,
this is not.
No, just go home. And I was like, okay, because I looked. And I was like, I don't look anything like these dudes right now. So there was also, like you said, it's not even an age experience thing. It's just how you look that you walk into the room. They're like, not now. I can see you in a couple years, but not now. And
I had a joke with my friend that the real test is you have to be able to believably say the line, my first marriage was a disaster. If you could say that line and I'm like, I believe it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then you've crossed the Rubicon, right? Yeah. You're now in a different age range of jobs for men, you know? And all these characters, like a character that looks like they've gone through something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because
at that time, it was also all of like, it was like High School Musical. It was like all the Zac Efron movies. She's all that. Freddie Prinze Jr. and stuff. And it was just like, I'm too old to play high school, even though they are, but they have the beneficiaries behind them to make that happen for them. It's not going to happen for me. But apart from me, I remember coming home after I moved to Sweden. You were living off a fountain. I think it was Fountain and next to La Cienega.
Olive?
Fountain and... No, you weren't in... You were in
Olive. Yeah, yeah. Right by La Cienega. Yeah.
And we went out for lunch. We walked from the courtyard that you were living in. And you were like, yeah, I told my agent, dude, you have to start pitching me for stuff for me, not what, because you were at the breaking point. Like, if I don't get something, I'm quitting. I'm going back into the restaurant industry because it was around that dry patch. But the way that you presented it to your agent was, I've been seen for stuff that isn't necessarily me. I need you to start working for me. And then the next year, do you remember this conversation?
Yeah. And I don't know if I was right. You know, I think the hard part is that there's a big hole in the donut for men. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of roles when you're young and there's a lot of roles when you're older, and there's not as many roles for a guy who's neither a boy nor a man. You know what I mean? And
especially if you haven't been in the industry before.
Yeah. Especially if you don't have like deep connections or like, you know what I mean? Like, or deep pocketed parents who are just going to be like, hey, we'll just support you for 8 years while you get through this dry patch. You know, you can go do plays and have fun. I've had such great representation. Like, you know, there are horror stories out there, and I've been so lucky that looking back, I honestly think, I just don't know if there's anything I or they could have done. You know what I mean? That fast forwarded me to the age that I need to be castable, you know? But the hard thing is, do you have an agent who's really going to, and I did, luckily, you know, I did have reps who just stuck with me, you know, through, you know, a lot of rejection, you know? Which is why I often say, like, you know, if there's somebody who's young and they're like, hey, I'm thinking about going to school, you know, because, you know, I'm really talented and I've got a good look. I'm like, great. If you're really talented at acting, don't go to acting school. Go to directing school. Go learn how to write, you know, because what's unfortunate right now is, casting directors, or I mean, like, I think, I don't want to blame it on casting, but like the casting system, you know, because actually casting directors, I think, are some of the most brilliant people out there. But the system around that they have to work in, the casting system, is almost like AI. It can be trained on what it knows, and but it can't make up something new and creative, right? It's the same with casting, right? If they get like some young, awesome actor, right? Then they're going to, then that person's broke through now. And they're like, now we're looking for something new now, but only this kind of new, right?
Yeah.
We're not going to take the lesson away and be like, oh, like idiosyncratic person, we'll go and look for other awesome idiosyncratic people. That's not how it works. They're going to be like, we're going to look for this type of person out here.
Yeah.
And the only way to get around that is if you are in control. I think young, I was raised in the last generation of people who were like, don't do everything. Just be an actor. Don't spread yourself thin. Just dedicate yourself to the art of acting. I think it's probably, without realizing, it was the worst advice that they could ever have given us, right? Done. I mean, just to talk you up a little bit, like, I remember things were, they were going fine for you, but they were going a predictable type of fine, right? And you were just like, seemed fed up. You're like, I'm in this box. I don't like being in this box. I'm going to Sweden. And every one of, I remember everybody's like, what?
Yeah.
Like, that's an out of the box choice. And you didn't have some clear cut, perfect path when you landed either. It was just like, I'm just going to totally blaze my own path and I'm going to see what happens. And look what's happened to you. Yeah. I don't know if you're going to include in the video all the things that you told me in the beginning that you're doing right now, but it's unbelievable the amount of things that you're doing. And you couldn't have engineered a more unique kind of life path, right? But you didn't have that. It's not like you know which way to go. You just went a different direction. And I think I am much more encouraging young, talented voices. Like, great, you're a brilliant actor, fantastic. Do not go to acting school. We need stories for you, because otherwise you're going to be some brilliant, idiosyncratic person with a wonderful human experience, and we're never going to fucking see it, because the people who are writing it don't know you. You know what I mean? And like, for example, you were saying there were no roles for you, because nobody's thinking like, how do I write a role for Gamble? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like you need somebody, and that's what you do as an actor. You're just sitting there being like, please, 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 I wonder if they're going to write a role that just is like, imagines like my personal life experience into it. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, like, go be a stand-up comedian, go write, go, you know, go be the storyteller, because right now in this industry, you want to know who has all the power. It's the storytellers, you know? Somebody out there right now who's young, please, God, you know what I mean? Like, go learn how to tell stories. If that's directing, if that's writing, I really do believe like that's your best path to being discovered is not. Somebody told me early on, they're like, don't take the ticket and wait in the line. No matter what you do, if you find yourself standing in line looking at C570, you know what I mean? He's like, get out of line. He's like, everybody's going to tell you, everybody, just take a ticket and stand in line. Everybody, don't do it. Do not do it. Do not take the ticket and stand in line. It's they're full of shit.
What made you move? Because you said you booked your first movie after NYU and you were still in New York. What made you decide to move to LA?
Honestly, social media. My friend Eddie Gathegi, you know, everybody was up their own ass about like, you know, theater and like going to NYU and how good NYU grad was and blah, blah, blah. I was so up my own ass about that. We all were. And Eddie was like, the only one who's like, nah, I'm going to go to LA. And we were like, what? Dude, you're so good. You can do theater. He's like, I know I can do theater. I just want to go to LA. And we were like, dude, what are you talking about? And for the first time, because of Facebook, it was like right around that moment. Whereas like you had a friend, like I had some friends moving to LA, and then you would see them posting just the life that they were living. I was like, I'd be sitting there like in a basically like a sleeping bag sized, you know, jacket in a New York winter, or like, you know, showing up to an audition just like covered in sweat and going and taking a miniature bath, you know, bath in the bathroom and putting on a new shirt so I could look halfway human, but still sweating like crazy on my audition. New York is a grind, man. And all of a sudden I saw my friends and how they were living in LA, and like I saw where they were living, and I was like, sign me up for that. Now, this was a different time in LA. This was what, 2007?
Yeah.
And then I think even post the 2008 crisis, like a lot of rental prices went down. So I had friends, you know, two, three guys would move into a huge single family home, rent it for next to nothing. They had a pool. It was a great time. It was musician friends of mine were all moving. I mean, honestly, my entire friend group like picked up and like within the same 2 year period, all relocated to LA, my entire friend group. Because New York just got priced up to the level where it was just insane rent, you know? And then LA was down. And then, of course, over the next 10 to 15 years, LA just went crazy again.
Bananas. It went fucking bananas is what it went. So Dollhouse was the first booking you had in LA?
It was the first series regular role that I booked ever. It was the first big job. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did it continue into episodics after that, or did you get into film, or what was, because we already know that the commercial thing didn't work out.
I just, dude, to be honest, like I could sit here and bullshit you. Like, you know, the truth of the matter is I just survived, you know, I did. And that was right around the time when all of a sudden, like you used to have a quote, so you could kind of earn and increase your quote. And you had a quote even for, recurring or a guest star. That was right around the time when people were like, no, we're just going to pay you like SAG minimum, you know, for everything. No negotiation. You're just getting SAG minimum, you know? And so it was, it also coincided with the time when just everybody was making less. There's just like a lot less money to go around. And, you know, that's when they really started to put the vices on everybody, all the, you know, all of the networks and stuff, and slowly squeeze. But to be honest with you, like until Agent Carter, I was really just barely surviving, keeping my head above water. I'd make a few bucks on something and then save every single penny. I would never spend money. I was always living super cheap, and literally right around when I'd be at zero and I would be like, I can't pay for the next month of rent. You know, I would somehow, something would come in, you know? So then, you know, Agent Carter saved me, you know, like, but I will say this, as grateful as I am for the big jobs, you know, there's these people who have hired me, like, Tara Butters and Michelle Fizikas. They worked with me on Dollhouse, and then, rehired me on Agent Carter. But they've also hired me in all of these small jobs. And weirdly, I'm more proud of those jobs that probably I'd be almost embarrassed for somebody to see right now. Those are the jobs that kept me alive though, you know? So like in a weird way, when you get on a big show and there's like, you know, that's a whole machine and everybody's so talented. Like I can't say like, oh man, I'm so proud. There were times when I had to dig deep and I'm like, if I don't book this job, it's the most horrible job in the world. But if I don't book this job, I'm out of the game. You know what I mean? And going on something like that and booking the job and then doing a good job and getting paid, I think to this day, I'm probably more proud of some of these jobs that no one would ever have heard of, you know, and more grateful to people like Tara and Michelle who threw me work, you know. Like small jobs here and there, just enough food to keep me alive. You know, it's easy. Like when you're having a conversation like this to like rewrite history and be like,
right,
yeah, it was destiny. You know what I mean? It was all destined. It was not destined. You know what I mean? There was so many times when that one job that they threw me, that one recurring that they threw me, was the difference between me continuing in the industry or not, you know? And I'm extremely grateful to those people who've, you know, worked with me again and kept, you know, threw me work, you know?
Yeah.
It meant everything.
Two questions and a statement. I'll get through them. First question is, you're leading to Agent Carter. Well, it's part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. What a lot of people don't realize, and when I saw the movie, I screamed in the freaking movie theater, like, your New York cop appearance in Avengers.
Yeah. Different character, but yes. Yeah.
Are those, like, from that small character, did that have anything to play with you getting Agent Carter, or was that just a one-off?
No, Joe Desposito was in charge of directing the pilot, mm-hmm. and he was casting everything. And I don't think he knew until after I was already cast that I was even in the Avengers. I don't think he put it together because it's such a small role. I mean, it's,
yeah,
you know, cop number two. You know, I don't think it even had a name. You know,
hey bro, you're cop number two, and I saw your ass immediately. I was like,
it was fun. I mean, it, you know, that was something, talk about somebody throwing me some work. That was, Joss Whedon. That was Joss. Basically he was like, hey, it's a small role. Do you want to come? And like, I think it'd be fun for the Dollhouse fans to see like a little Easter egg. Yeah. And I was like, absolutely. I will play cop number two on the Avengers. Yes. Thank you, Joss. Like, you know, that job made a big difference. That job, that money got me through, you know? I don't think he knew about that. And so we asked, because at the time, I think there was a policy, among casting directors that if you were already in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you couldn't audition. And so, it was a long time after I was, you know, I got cast and then this, and I finally got on set and got into a moment where I could ask Joe, like, hey, why did you decide? Did you guys have a discussion about whether or not it would be okay? Or how you would, justify the fact that I played cop number two and I'm also playing this different character. I love Joe Desposito. He's the greatest guy. He was like, who cares? Because, you know, Marvel has such a
stronghold
vision for,
yeah,
and a stronghold on like in very specific, and Joe just decided like, I don't care, like, no,
except for the fact small. Except for the fact that Chris Evans was Johnny Flame and Captain America, but you know.
You know, like, I'm glad for whatever reason, Joe just decided it's all good, you know? But that was a dream job. Like, Agent Carter is like, I almost can't even watch it objectively as a TV show, because if you knew how fun it was to be on set, I mean, it felt illegal. It felt absolutely like it should be illegal. The writers were the biggest pranksters. Like, they were almost like they were on set all the time, prank, you know, like, I was like, it just felt like we shouldn't be having that much fun, you know?
Yeah.
And everybody was so close. We're still close to this day. There's a huge text thread that I'd say almost once a week will go off, you know, with a lot of people who are still on it. You know, it's like, It was a dream job, and I love all of them dearly, and I'm still close to a bunch of them. I thought they were all going to be that way, so you know, I was almost kind of like, because Dollhouse we were pretty tight too, mm-hmm. and so then after that I would go on to set and I'd be like, hey guys, we're all doing a show together. We're all going to be a family. You know, people like, You know, like I thought everybody was just super close all the time because my first two jobs, everybody was like so tight, you know. I didn't realize that it was not always going to be like that. Yeah. You know, but
memory for the heart. Question number two. When you played in the movie Stone, you played not young Robert De Niro, but you played Robert De Niro's young character's younger self.
Yeah.
Young Jack?
I don't know. That movie was crazy. It was such a crazy experience.
If you could see, I might have to use this clip. If you can see his face while he's talking about this. What was it like auditioning as a young De Niro? Did you get to meet De Niro? Did he have anything to say about you playing
him? No, I was in Berlin. I was in Berlin and I auditioned on tape from Berlin. It was one of the first times I actually had a camera and I figured out how to set it up to the laptop and like use the Wi-Fi. Like everything, all the technology came together where I could be somewhere else and just send an audition in. And I was in Berlin at the time and they were like, you got to audition for this. But I cut my trip short to go home and do the movie. But no, I didn't meet anybody. I met De Niro briefly only because we had separate storylines. I only met him like, gosh, I mean, I think maybe I shook his hand. Like, I can't remember it. You know what I mean? It was crazy. It was an absolute nightmare.
I
remember going in and I was like, hey, I don't want to do some like big De Niro like thing, but like maybe we could do something like super small to approximate it. Cause it's like, you know, I'm supposed to be De Niro and he has that little mole, you know? And the hair and makeup department was like, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to try to do it. You're just going to be you and you're like a young version of him. I was like, oh, okay, cool. No problem. You know? And I thought that was coming from the director. I get on set. We're about to shoot. And the director comes and looks at me. He's like, where's the mole? And they're like, what? And he's like, the fucking mole. It's De Niro. I mean, he's a fucking mole. What? Like, he's like, he grew a mole? Like, you got to have a fucking mole. Like, and so in the moment, they took a little piece of wax, like a booger, and like kept trying to like put some, so they kept trying, and it kept falling off. So basically they had some like piece of wax that they were trying to stick to my face and it ended up being bigger than fucking De Niro's actual role. You know what I mean? Cause like we're putting it, cause since they did it last minute, it would look so shitty because they hadn't done it correctly. And then there was this scene where I had to be that we had twin girls because, you know, basically you always have twins when you have kids cause you burn one of them out, you know, and then you need to switch.
Right.
To
a new one.
So also on top of, and the mole kept falling off. So we'd be in the middle of a shot. They'd be like, wait a minute, that was a good take, but where's the mole? The mole's gone. You know what I mean? Plus I had this thing where I was kicking out a screen window and I was holding this kid out of the screen, pretending that I was going to throw the kid out of the screen window. And the first kid started screaming and immediately. She was like out. And then the second kid, like I would have to do this thing where I'd have, like, I was like, I'd have to go from being like really nice because I couldn't be mean because the kid would start crying. So I'd be like, hey, we're going to pretend. Okay. So like when I pretend, you're going to just like close your eyes. Right. The kid was so adorable, man. And so I'd have to be that way right up until action. And I'd be like, okay, ready to go. And like be super nice. And then on action, I'd be like, action. And I would have to kick it open and be like, I swear to fucking God. You know? And the girl, oh my God, I'll never forget it. The girl, like she was pretending to be asleep, but she would keep her arms out like a little kangaroo, right? And so I would have to be like, I don't know, so I'd be like, okay, noodle arms. Like I said something like noodle arms. I was like, okay, noodle arms. You know, she would do this. You know what I mean? So her arms would go down. She forgot. She's scared. And I was holding her out of a real window, right? Like, and this is another thing that I thought was just insane. So they were like, hold her outside. I was like, I'm not holding the child outside of a window. Like, so between that, and then like, and then in the middle of the take, they'd be like, your eyes are open. I'd be like, hey, honey, like, can you close your eyes? You know? So I'd have to stop screaming and then talk to her and then go back to screaming. And then the mole would be gone. Dude, it was so bad. It is honestly, it may be the worst. Maybe the worst like situation I've ever had in my life. Like,
have you seen the movie?
To this day.
Have you seen the scene in actual post production? Nope. The slow.
I mean, I did like I think at one point I watched and I started to watch some of the stuff. I watched the beginning and I just stopped watching. It's not a triumph. I'll tell you that much. Like I will say this: there's a lot of things that I've booked in my life that I've been at the time. Everybody's like, go in there. This is it, man. Go buy the BMW, go buy the house. It's done for you. Like it's from here. It's just a straight line up, you know? And this was one of those, they were like, oh man, Robert De Niro, Edward Norton, you're playing a young De Niro. It's over, buddy. Like from here on out, it's nothing but blue skies. And I was like, I'm not going to buy the car just yet. You know, I think I'll wait until the movie comes out. And I'm glad I did. It's like, it's not a triumph, that movie. It's not, I don't think it's something that either De Niro or Edward Norton are really holding up as their best work.
Okay, we'll leave it there. I actually have two comments. So I said two questions and one comment, but I have two questions that I just did and now two comments / statements. One of you know what's coming up next. One of my favorite moments of your career is a highlight of mine. I get a phone call from Enver. Hey, buddy, I need your help for something. I'm like, yeah, what's up? And he happens to live down the street. It's when you lived on Garfield, maybe the house on the end of the corner with the.
We're going to be so LA here if we start talking about intersections.
So I go over to this house and your room was upstairs. I'm like, all right. I'm like, what's up, bud? He goes, I need to dance like a stripper. Yeah. I'm like, what? Like, I need some.
Explain. Like, we should just leave that there and just walk away. And the whole, and then everybody would be like, okay, and that would almost be better.
All right, you know what? I will do that. I'll leave it there. And what I will do is on the Instagram account, I post clips of what my guests have done. I will post that as a clip.
Or not. Short version is I was on a sci-fi TV show where I needed my personality to have been accidentally swapped with a drunk sorority girl but I'm in the body of a man, and like it was a very interesting sci-fi premise, and they wanted me to be dancing like a drunk sorority girl, and I was like, dude, I don't know the first thing about how a drunk sorority girl dances. And so I was like, but I know who does. I know who does. And so you give me some moves. They were so impressed. So there was this director who was he was our producing director, so he did a lot of the episodes. So I knew him very well. And they basically, they prepped everybody. They're like, this guy's going to be dancing, but we don't want you, like, you got to, like, don't pay attention. Just let him do his thing. You know what I mean? Like, don't. They had me doing so much stuff. They were like, I was sweating and, like, breathing heavy. They had me dancing forever because you gave me so much stuff to do. And finally, I was just like, I need a water break. And I was just drinking some water. And I said to the director, he came up to me. I was like, dude, you guys got this or what? And he was like trying not to laugh. He's like, we had it like an hour ago, dude. He's like, we just were having so much fun. We were like, when is he going to just stop coming up with moves? You know what I mean? Like, we thought we would do one or two moves. Like, what you see is nothing, dude. They had an hour of footage of me just like going at it.
And then the other beautiful part that you told me after I saw the episode is that the actor that's playing against you was actually not told this is what you're going to be doing. So the reactions you see of the people in the scene are actually real.
No, that's right. Because when they first brought in the extras, they hadn't told them, because they wanted to get the genuine reaction. They hadn't told the extras what would be going on. So they thought it was just like a TV show, party, club scene, whatever. And then I start dancing. And the problem was, is everybody stopped. Like the whole club just stopped. And everybody's like, what is happening right now? And they had to be like, okay, now we'll do it again. Guys, it's okay to look at him and notice. It is weird, but you can't like all just stop dead in your tracks. like we still need people to be living their life, you know?
But that's what would happen if you see a dude who just goes up and starts doing
it. It was a little too real. It was a little too real. No, it was, that was a fun job. I mean, I got to play 10 characters in two seasons. You know, it was, I didn't realize at the time it was just a once in a lifetime opportunity. It was like, it'll never happen again. Like that premise to be able to do something like that. So fun.
I'll forever cherish that moment. Thanks for bringing me in for that one. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about. So this was 2012, 2013. I think it was 2000. It was either 2012 or 2013. We hadn't seen each other for a while because I'd been working a lot. And then you were going to be in Europe. And you're like, bro, what are you doing for the next 36 hours? I'm like, what's up? I'm going to be in Berlin. Can you make it to Berlin? Tell me date, tell me time. I'll be there. I literally flew to Berlin for 36 hours. I slept for 6 hours, the entire 36 hours. I landed at 7 p.m. Met him at the apartment. We went to some bar that you knew the bartender. It was just the two of us at the bar. And then her girlfriend came, and then there was another guy that was working, and it was just us at the bar. And then it got to be like 3 o'clock.
All you had to say was Berlin. Yeah, that's all you have to say. Like,
we'll leave it there.
Everybody gets it. Like, we went to Berlin. Now you're just describing Berlin.
Like, okay. Yeah. So, but then there's also this Italian restaurant. Do you remember the name of this Italian restaurant that we went to? That was literally the best Italian I've ever had. You had been there once before, maybe, but when we sat, like, they liked us so much that they did the typical Italian thing and was like, so you guys would have some limoncello. We're like, not really. It was.
It might have been my friend Pepe's place, because my friend Pepe lives in Berlin. Maybe it was Pepe's restaurant.
I have a picture of it somewhere. I will find it. That Italian restaurant was by far one of the best Italian restaurants I've ever been in. It was good.
Oof, I'm missing Berlin, man. I'm like, I really want to get back.
I was going to ask you, when was the last time you were there? So we're long overdue. So either way, it's been over 10 years since we were there.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons that I moved back to the East Coast is so that I could be closer to flying to Europe. You know, we want to spend a lot more time visiting and flying. It's just really tough from LA. People don't realize it's LA is great if you like to visit Vegas and Mexico. You know,
that's about it.
But that's about it in terms of like exotic destinations, you know, or at least that's it that you can do easily. And I have a bunch of friends who live in Europe, and it's been so hard for me to connect with them.
You even came to Sweden.
I love Sweden. And honestly, I loved your town, man.
Gothenburg.
Gothenburg is amazing. And I love Stockholm. Stockholm was brilliant. But I was so surprised by Gothenburg. It's such a beautiful city. There's some places where you feel like, this is a great place to be here for the weekend. Yeah. And there's some places where you're like, man, I could live here. This place is like so livable. Gothenburg, I just was like, when do I move here? This is so wonderful. I mean,
Because when you came to Gothenburg, you're like, oh, dude, I really want to go to Stockholm. I was like, cool, we can go to Stockholm, but I'll be there for like 2 days. I'll stay with you for like 2 days. I'm not a big, like, I like Stockholm, but I like it because I can leave. And we got up there and we're walking around for literally 20 minutes. And you just turn to me and you go, You're right. I get you. You, Stockholm is nice. It's the capital city, but there's just something about Gothenburg that you just feel like at home. I'm like, yeah, it's just,
yeah,
this is great. So but come on.
Also, you were like the mayor of Gothenburg at the time. Like, we couldn't even walk down the street without you meeting like five people. So, you know,
Gambleburg is known as Gothenburg. Gothenburg is known as Gambleburg.
But, you know, I mean, I always prefer to travel that way. Whenever I'm traveling, I would always rather go someplace that I don't know about if a friend is there, because I know I'm going to get a genuine, I'm going to get a peek at a genuine lifestyle.
Right. You know? What the locals do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really hoping I'll be out there again soon. I'm going to be in Vancouver for a bit.
I might come out this summer. As I said, I'm looking at my summer. This is my first summer off in 2 years, or my actual first time off in 2 years. So trying to plan that out. And if you're there and Judy's there, I will try and make that over.
Easy trip from LA. Are you going to be in LA?
Yeah.
Yeah. I figured.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Well, how was that? How did we do?
We're not done yet. Okay. There's one more sequence before we go. So, okay. One, I normally say what's next, but we already know you're going to shoot the show in Vancouver. That's next. But my last name is Gamble. So I went and bought a roulette table filled with 16 shot glasses that are numbered. Each number represents a question. We spin the roulette table. We spin the wheel. It pops on a number. You answer a question. It's nothing too intruding or private or anything like that. It's just
fun. Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah. You up for it?
Yes.
Ready?
Yeah.
Round and round and round we go. Where it stops, nobody knows. Number 24. Number 24. Where are you, 24? Oh. I haven't done this in a while. On the house. Whatever you want people to know.
Here's what I'll say. I think this is what I'm moved to say today. Is I think I want people to know, if somebody's listening to this and has listened to the end for some reason, you know, what I would want to share with people is like, no matter what you do, people have this advice, right? Find that thing that you love and do that, right? I found the thing that I loved. And it's like, I'll tell you what, if you like growing tomatoes, don't become a tomato farmer. At a certain point, it is going to become commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And, really, I think I got to a point where I was really hating my life and in a very privileged position and still hating myself and what I was doing, just really disliking my circumstances. And I had to find a way not to just change my scenery and move to a different city. I had to find a way to do all the same stuff for a different reason. You know, and so I would just say, like, for me, not necessarily advertising, but if you're the kind of person out there who's kind of been doing the same thing and is not happy with it, for me, what worked was to get to the point where I was so sick and tired of the status quo that I was ready to try something different. I tried just about everything that involved me elevating myself and me being bigger. And what changed for me, the only big thing in my life that ever changed, is I started to become more interested in being better than being bigger, you know? Mm-hmm. And I started to become more interested for the first time ever in being a son and a brother and an uncle. I really, before then, only wanted to represent somebody very, very admirable on camera, right? That's all. I didn't want to be an admirable person. I just wanted to be an admirable person on camera. Mm-hmm. And for me, for some reason, I had to just become interested in trying, at least, to embody those kind of qualities in my personal life. And weirdly enough, as soon as I changed my kind of North Star, all the things that I was pushing on that were seemed immovable started to move forward, you know? And so for me, believe me, if you're out there and you're an asshole and it's working for you, you know what I mean? Keep doing it. Keep going. You know what I mean? I'm like,
don't take that advice.
You know, like I've seen plenty of people out there who are not great people and they are super successful. If that's working for you, great. God love you. But if it's not working for you, what changed for me is that I started to just think of like, how can I be additive? How can I add to other people? How can I help this script? How can I help this person? How can I help this thing? And I started doing that. Somebody encouraged me to try to think about that. And then my life completely changed, you know? Everything changed on and off screen. And so, you know, I'm a big advocate of service. I'm going to end with this story. Mm-hmm. Years before this was miserable. I'd gotten so close to so many big life-changing jobs, this close, and had not gotten to it. And I was sitting with a therapist in a room, and this guy had a tendency to doze on me, you know? And so I'm sitting there and I'm talking about like, God, I don't understand, you know, why is my luck so bad? I'm complaining about, you know, me. And this guy kind of is like nodding off, and he does this kind of thing where he catches himself. He almost wakes himself up, you know,
My God. And
out of nowhere, mid-sentence, I'm complaining out of nowhere. He kind of catches himself and interrupts me and starts saying, hey, have you ever thought about volunteering? And I was like, wait,
what?
What are you? I was like, yeah, I guess. But I mean, I'm talking about this. I'm talking about like, I'm trying to tell you about X, Y, and Z that is driving me insane. He's like, oh, well, I just thought like, you know, I work at this hospital. You can always volunteer. You can come down and volunteer at the hospital. For years, my takeaway from that situation was like, I thought it was funny because I caught this guy dozing on the clock and he just was trying to kind of catch himself. Now, years later, I honestly don't think that's what was happening at all. I think he was so sick and fucking tired of hearing me complaining about myself, you know, knowing what he knew, which was that my problem was that I was all about me. That mm-hmm. was my problem. My problem is that the beginning, middle, and end of all my problems was me. And I had no conception that being of service to somebody might be something that I would do other than just being like, I'm retired and bored, so maybe I'll volunteer, you know? Mm-hmm. That was my attitude. And as with a lot of things, with time, I look back on it now and I was like, this guy was really trying to tell me something, you know? He was trying a lot of years before I was able to hear it. He was trying to say like, man, maybe the problem is you, you know? And I think the shorthand version of that whole story is somebody defined humility one time. He said, humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. And to bring it all back, if I want to leave anybody with something that I've learned, you know, and something that I've taken with me, a lesson that I learned the hard way, like really had to be forced upon me. It was that, you know, and my life ever since having that realization, it wasn't like a light bulb moment. I'm still a very flawed person. I'm still working on a lot of different things. But ever since I realized that as being my fundamental issue, my life has gotten just unbelievably better on every single metric. So yeah, I would like to share that with people.
Boom. Take note, people. Words from the man himself, Mr. Enver Jokai, my boy.
Thank you, man. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Thank you for I was going to say humbly being my friend, but what I mean by humbling me and being my friend. Like, it's like,
I'm the lucky one, man.
I remember always the night that you were sitting. I just like Stu's sitting at the bar. He doesn't seem too happy. Hey man, you okay? Do you want a drink? And you're just like, sure.
I was not happy at that time. I was not a happy person, you know. But it's amazing. It's like you were a bright spot in my life then. And I always find it strange, you know. There's been so many friends along the way, and some people come and some people go. There's nothing wrong with it. But I love the beautiful kismet of the strangeness of the people who stay. You know what I mean? Like, it's like how, you know, I just never realized in that moment. I was like, oh, this is a cool guy at this bar. Years later, and honestly, through a major personal transitions that we've had, we're still here. You know, I think it's so beautiful.
We're a good balance. Quick question. If the listeners want to find out more about Mr. Jokai, can they find him anywhere online?
I don't really do the socials anymore.
IMDb and Wikipedia. We'll leave it there.
Probably. I just refuse to go away. So usually what happens is people just like are flipping through channels and you'll see me.
Yeah.
So I'm that guy. I'm quite happy to be that guy. It's like, oh, I've seen him somewhere.
Yeah. Awesome song. Hey, the only reason why I'm on social media is because freaking Judy made my profile before I moved to Sweden. And like, that's it. I absolutely hate Facebook, but I use it now because I'm so many places around the world. And you know, when I send my email updates, like I would rather do that just to like, hey guys, I'm still alive, miss you, or I'll freaking call you or I'll text you. Like I'll do that.
I agree. They have incredible functionality that they've like somehow just completely sidetracked from, you know. It's like, let's get back to the core functionality.
But unfortunately, while we're saying that, if you're not doing it, make sure you follow at Campbell's Green Room on Instagram to make sure you stay up to date.
Never mind. Yeah, I'm always on Instagram.
Because I'm bitching about it as well as like, so while I'm doing this, let me do a shameless plug as well to follow my Instagram.
But I will tell you, podcasts, I do love.
Yeah.
I do love podcasts. Yeah.
And
YouTube. I'm all over YouTube.
YouTube? Oh, the visual podcast and stuff. Nice. Man, bro, I hope to see you either in Vancouver this summer or getting you back over to Berlin or Sweden and meeting the partner or even coming to the ATL and seeing the house, like, if any of those can happen.
Can't wait.
Looking forward. As I wrote over New Year's, time and distance is just a man-made concept. We're still here. And I'll see you next time. I love you so much, bro. Thank you so much for doing this.
Love you, brother.
I'll see you soon.
All right, dude.